The Recap Show is an inside look for fans into the world of global soccer, women's sports, and all things gal culture.
From the inside perspective of two World Cup champions and Olympians.
Follow and listen to The Recap Show wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's go right now to Buffalo attorney of note, Paul Cambria. Paul, thanks a lot. Appreciate your time.
No problem.
Well, let's talk about the situation. First of all, overall, have you been following this Nancy Guthrie thing terribly closely?
Not that closely. I know that obviously there's a missing person, and the police seem to have some clues, but it doesn't seem like they're close.
Does it surprise you because you've got so many law enforcement resources, including the feds, dedicated to this? Does it surprise you that they're still putting up billboards and it seems like they're doing the basic stuff, like bringing forensic video to Nancy Guthrie's house now?
Well, I think that they're more concentrating on a search warrant, some active situation where they can go in and actually be boots on the ground trying to locate her. That's usually the first part of the decision is let's save the person and make sure that they're not in physical harm.
Paul, the other night, the guy was captured. It was so weird. This guy, the story goes, supposedly, and again, this is just a story. It's what we think we know. The story goes that this individual was recognized by somebody on that video footage. Somebody anonymously dropped a dime on him. And supposedly, based on that, he was put under surveillance and they did a vehicle stop on him and SWAT team rolled and everything else. And there was talk of a search warrant that had been issued for some of his property. And what else? Oh, yes, he's the only person, as it turns out, in the country who's not heard of this story. I want to ask you, I mean, putting myself in that situation, if that happened to me, I would definitely be talking to you about a lawsuit.
Well, you know, it's difficult actually to successfully sue the police, and you can imagine why. Obviously, you know, the police need to have full range of weapons, if you will, to investigate crime. On the other hand, you know, they can't blatantly violate the law. So they start off, and their first thing is, what information do we have? And the second part of it is, is it credible? And if the source is credible and the facts are substantiated, then they seek a search warrant. And they need a location, obviously, and a specific location and specific items that they're trying to seek. You know, they have to go to a magistrate. They can't just do it on their own. Obviously, if something happens in front of them and someone is in jeopardy of being injured or whatever, the police can operate. But if they're trying to search someone's house or vehicle, they need a search warrant because the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution requires that. So they would have to go, to a judge, and they'd have to give reasons to the judge to support a conclusion that the information that they have, that material, let's say, is probably in a certain location, is credible. And the magistrate then has to also know the underlying circumstances, what facts are being relied upon. Sorry about that call.
You're right. I'm worried about you.
I'm okay.
Explain that whole search warrant process and the difference between detention and arrest and what you need to prove to even detain somebody. Could the guy have said no?
Well, let's take New York, for example. You need to have reasonable suspicion in order to detain someone and to ask them questions. And then, if you ask them questions and their answers are such that, more than suspicion is established, then you move on to the next step, which is probable cause. Sorry about my voice. Reasonable suspicion is necessary to stop someone and to question them. If you get probable cause, then that means that you have a basis to have credible information and to have factual information that would support a search warrant.
Now, do you, based on what you know, I'm going to ask you to speculate and hypothesize, do you believe that this case is going to be resolved? Do you believe that even if it's going to be tragic, we're eventually going to know the answers?
Well, you know, most times you do eventually know the answer, because if it's a missing person, they show up, either they're alive or they're not alive, and that's how you know the answer. And I would assume here that somewhere along the line, you know, there's going to be a determination as to whether someone is harmed or whether they're simply missing and it was an innocent circumstance as to why they were missing. So, you know, that remains to be seen. But in most cases, you know, the people are found and, you know, the story's told and the mystery's over.
Paul Cambria is with us, Buffalo defense attorney on News Radio 930 WBEN. I was thinking about this one as well. If it was a kidnapping situation, that's one thing. If it was a murder in her house and the removal of a body, obviously both are major felonies, but how would you go about proving whether the woman was alive when abducted or not?
Well, first of all, kidnapping is a major felony also.
Right.
You know, any kind of forceful taking and detention of an individual is a crime. And also can have similar implications, but more importantly, it's a crime. And so here, you know, eventually you'll find out whether or not someone was just legitimately lost, innocently lost. You know, just, I mean, that happens with individuals, especially with elderly people, or whether or not they were abducted in some way or detained, seized, and that's where the crime comes in. If somebody is seized against their will, that becomes a crime in all the states, and it can be federal crime if they cross state lines or if it's a federal individual, an employee, something like that.
Where does this leave a jurisdiction in terms of the feds versus state and local authorities?
Well, the federal people always have jurisdiction when it involves either interstate activity or it involves communications, things that travel across state lines, like phones and so on, vehicles. Once you start crossing state lines, that's federal territory. Once you start using communication systems, telephones, and so on, that's also federal territory. And the only way that it remains all state is if, you know, none of those things are used. You don't use a car, you don't use some communication device or anything like that. You don't cross state lines. It's something that just, you know, happens in a community and stays there. And it's all state.
History That Doesn't Suck is a legit, hard-hitting American history podcast told through entertaining stories. Join me, Professor Greg Jackson, for History That Doesn't Suck, an Odyssey podcast, available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Paul Cambria is with us on News Radio 930 WBEN. Paul, as you well know, it is statistically not even measurable that adults are the victims of abduction by adults who do not know them. As you analyze the big picture, have you any hypotheses about the potential of someone she knew being involved in this horrible situation?
Well, those, you know, the dynamics there are a little different. If it's someone you know, then those are cases where there was some ill wills along the lines. You know, it could have been a religious situation. It could have been a matrimonial situation, a boyfriend-girlfriend thing, a business partner thing. I mean, there's some kind of prior connection with the people that are involved. And then there's, a crime for a reason, not a legal reason, but, you know, it could be a mad business partner, it could be a bad lover, could be, you know, things like that. And that's when you get into kidnapping and so on. I realized, you know, the first time if you use the telephone or the mail or you go across state lines or whatever, it turns federal. You use a phone for a ransom, you use the mails for a ransom note, things like that. That makes it federal.
Paul, obviously you are a defense attorney. You screen out the fallacies, assumptions, and everything else in a prosecutor or a litigator's case. What would they need to have a successful prosecution of anybody they might arrest that they believe did it? And how important is the body or person?
Well, you know, the old corpus delicti, you know, that you don't need a body to be convicted of murdering someone. They don't need to ever find a body as long as the circumstantial evidence is strong enough to point to you as the perpetrator. And it could be, you know, you were seen with someone, there was DNA found in your house, hair fibers, clothing fibers. I'm trying to separate the two. Hair is one part, and clothing fibers and so on is another part. And so, you know, those are all the things you have to look at. But you don't necessarily have to have the so-called corpus delicti, you know, an actual body to convict someone of murder.
Mm-hmm. You make the argument by doing what? All of the fibers you mentioned earlier?
You do it circumstantially, you know, and it could be that you were, let's say the facts are this, the person was last seen with you, they were seen arguing, or they were seen you were fighting, or the person was seen with you at your house and blood from that person was found at your house, or clothing with skin cells were found at your house and they belonged to that person. You know, it's circumstantial evidence has to lead basically beyond a reasonable doubt to a conclusion that someone is someone did it, if you will. It can't just be maybe. Circumstantial evidence has to be strong, and all the facts must lead to an inevitable conclusion of guilt to convict someone with just circumstantial evidence.
Paul Cambria, Buffalo defense attorney on News Radio 930 WBEN. Hey, I think it was Gutfeld on Fox said, I've got a strategy to solve this situation. You have Savannah Guthrie take a polygraph test. Then the other members of her family are going to feel compelled or shamed into doing the same thing. Do you put any value? Obviously, it's inadmissible in court. Do you put any value into polygraphs?
Well, let me tell you how they use polygraphs effectively. The questions asked and the answers given, and not so much what the machine says, but what you might say. They might have the police, for example, if they have a homicide, they may ask questions which only the perpetrator would have an answer to. And the answers would be what would convict them as opposed to the polygraph itself. You know, a polygraph is just a tool to question people. You know, that's really the way it's used, a diagnostic tool, if you will, and to have people say things that may be incriminating.
Well, Paul, I'm going to give your voice a rest because I didn't mean to make you struggle, brother. I'm sorry about that.
No, it's okay. It's recovered.
Yeah, you're tough. I mean, you're a tough guy. You don't like to say it, but I know you're a tough guy.
And you talk for a living.
Yeah, and when I start to lose my voice, it really sucks, let me tell you that.
Exactly.
Paul, exactly. Man, thanks, Mary. I really appreciate your time, and I'm sure we're going to talk again in the not-too-distant future.
Not a problem.
Paul Cambria, Buffalo defense attorney on News Radio 930 WBEN.
Gone South has been a podcast about crime in the American South. But for our new season, we're widening the lens. Follow and listen to Gone South Season 5, available now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your shows.